Blog Talk Radio.
Production where we talk with authors, publishers, and movers and shakers in urban literature. I'm your host, Michelle Berard, founder and CEO of Urban Book Editor, LLC. And first, I want to say, wow, That is absolutely awesome. That was Still by Lenny Williams. I know you guys enjoyed that.
Yeah,
I sure did. I had to mute my line and be in here moving.
I know you got a bad will.
So, guys, I want to give a big shout-out to Ms. Beverly Black and Tribe Family Channel and the entire network of thought-provoking shows on Tribe Family Channel. Love, Lust, Lovers, Late Night Literature is a Tribe Family Channel creation sponsored by Urban Book Editor, LLC, and by Hosea and Tinsley Brooks, creators of the Player Line series of books. I'd also like to thank Earl Sewell, our guest from the February 16th show, for sharing his time and knowledge with us. If you guys missed that episode, please, please visit Tribe Family Channel and look for the on-demand shows to listen to the replay. Now, many of our guests will already be familiar with tonight's guest. Many of our listeners, rather, will be familiar with tonight's guest and his work, especially if they enjoy urban literature and crime novels. I just can't tell you how happy I am to have him on the show. Quan is a prolific writer, having produced more than 20 books, and his audience is constantly clamoring for more. He has been featured in tons of publications, including Vibe, Pages, King, The Library Journal, Entertainment Weekly, The New York Press, and Time Magazine, just to name a few. Quan was also the recipient of the 2012 and 2013 Street Lit Book Award medals in adult fiction for Eviction Notice and Animal. His credits include featured commentary in the award-winning documentary Iceberg Slim, Portrait of a Pimp, which was produced by Ice-T, as well as a recurring guest role on TV One's Celebrity Crime Files. Quan currently resides in New Jersey, where he spends much of his time writing. So with no further delay, I would like to welcome Quan to Love, Lust, Lovers. Hello, Quan. How are you?
Hey, what's going on, guys?
Oh, it's great. Are you in New Jersey freezing right about now?
No, I'm not freezing. It's actually pretty nice right now. The winter has not been kind, but it's not as bad as it was last year.
Okay, well, that's good to know. All I keep hearing is how you guys out on the East Coast are suffering right now. Meanwhile, you know, hey, man, I'm just telling you what they're saying about all these nor'easters coming in and messing folks up.
Yeah, we definitely keep getting old. I mean, when you compare it to you guys on the West Coast, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, that California weather. I'm so jealous right now.
As well you should be, I'm just going to say.
Well, I know. Let me tell you something. I used to live in Carson, and had I not had a kid, I would probably still be in Carson.
Wow. Well, we look forward to having you out here on the West Coast again sometime soon. And
definitely.
I am super excited to have you on the show because you are such a prolific writer. I mean, you've produced so many novels. It's really impressive. So I'd like to ask you, how did you start writing?
By accident, really. Writing for me was more like a therapeutic thing. When my mom got sick, I would write as my therapy. And I was arguing with my daughter's mom, and she was just really just on my nerves. I don't even know what she was just on my back. I think she was on my back because, like, we had this whole, like, we had two different ideas of how I should be living my life. And she was on my back about something, and I'm like, you're just such a pain in the ass. And I started characterizing her on a piece of a paper bag, making this character up, and I named the character Martina. So, and Martina birthed Lulo, who was the dude she was always yelling at in Gutter, who Lulo told his problems to, and so on and so forth. So with that, and then even with it, I didn't want to be a writer. I was just like kind of messing around. So when my mom got sick, I picked it back up, and I started really fleshing the story out. By the time my mom died, I had come to the attention of Vicki Stringer. Because I used to I've always been a big reader. Ever since I was a little kid, that's one thing my mother always, it was not even a choice. Like, I had to read a certain amount of books every day, every week, or whatever. So I had a lot of books, and I still have more books than I know what to do with. So I was content when I got this writing itch. But truthfully, it was more me trying to help my mother get published before she got sick.
Oh, okay.
And I ended up writing this story literally on her deathbed. I wrote Gangster. when Mo was on the deathbed. And so I started hitting up different authors who had their information listed on their books, and just like, you know, I'm looking for a little guidance. Like, I don't want no deal, I don't want no handout. Some people were mean to me. Well, the majority of people were very mean to me. Vicky was receptive. And she was like, you know, I sent her the synopsis, and she was like, man, this is good. Like, and I didn't know a good story from a bad story. I was venting. I was just getting something off my chest. So she was like, this is good. Now, I can't believe nobody's offered you a deal for this. This is magnificent. This is great work. So she was like, well, I can help you to get a deal, and you just give me a finder's fee, or I can sign you to this publishing house that I'm trying to start called Triple Crown. You'll be first offer. So my thinking was, if you don't have no authors, then I can pick your brain as much. I don't have to fight for roster space, and I don't have to be in a big stable of authors. I can pick your brain as much as I want. And so let's do it like that. And the most amazing thing happened. But right before, and this kind of should have been a red flag. Not a red flag. I think that's a poor choice of words. Right before the book came out, Vicky had sent out feelers, like the manuscript, the rough draft manuscript, I guess email, PDF. Like, I didn't even know how to use email like that back then. However, she sent it out. And people were trying to buy my contract. People were throwing all kinds of money, like, this kid is going to be something special. Like, who is he? Nobody knew what I looked like. Nobody knew if I really existed or whether I was just someone she created in her imagination, because I was very reclusive. Like, I was still doing stuff I had no business doing. So, like, and there was no big social media presence. So people did not know if Kawan was a real person. Like, because you got to look at it like, okay, there's just one name off of Kawan. Who the hell is that other than Zane? Like, who is this person? So they were trying to buy my contract. And it got so overwhelming that Vicky was like, I'm just going to let you go. Why don't you just go ahead and let me sell your contract, so you can get with a publisher that really knows what to do with you. And I might know, because they weren't around and they didn't want to do anything with me when I was trying to find my way. So, you know, let's fuck them and feed them to, excuse my language, forget him and feed them to the fish. Let's see what happens with Triple Crown. I got my first copy of Gangsta. We printed 10,000, I think, was the first run. I got my first copies on Christmas Eve of 2002. By maybe the second week of January, they were all gone. They sold so fast that we hadn't had a chance to recoup the money that we sent for the books on consignment. So we couldn't reprint again until March. So there was like a 2-month gap. So we still, there's like, if you know, there's two different versions of, well, three now. There's one version of Gangsta, which is the original with the black cover. And then you'll notice there's another one with a gray cover. That was the reprint, and something happened with the printer, and the color got diluted or whatever. So this is why people think Gangsta came out in 2003. It actually came out in 2002. We just didn't get the money back to print again until like around that time. So, and that was the first one. The second book I wrote because she dared me to write it. She told me, she cooked up the story and was like, everybody's talking about you. They said you're a one-hit wonder. You can't do it again. And I'm like, man, this is easy for me. I wrote Road Dogs and so on and so forth. And it kind of just... it just was something that felt nasty to me. It was the first thing I ever done in my life that felt good.
The first thing you'd ever done in your life that felt good. Would you mind elaborating on that?
I was doing wrong. Like, everything in my life was going to hell. I was about to be a father. Me and the girl that I was having a baby with, we didn't have the best relationship. I was running around. I was in the street, and she was doing whatever she was doing. I didn't feel like I was in a position to be anybody's father. My mother... My mother didn't raise me. I was raised by whatever relative would have me, because I'm a child of the crack era. So you know how, like, when crack hit, it kind of tore a lot of families apart. So, like, I floated around from relative to relative. Everybody took turns taking in Brenda's time. So everything was kind of going bad for me. I was at my bottom. I hit my bottom. So I'm eating ramen noodles 3 times a day, breakfast, lunch, and dinner. So I was at my bottom. And I'm like, man, this is, you know, why am I even here? Why do I exist? Why am I alive? I'm serving no purpose. I found out the girl was pregnant. So now I have this baby about to come, and I have no way to feed it. I have no idea how I'm going to feed this child. It did not ask to be brought into this world, but it's about to be here. And it's the most amazing thing. We were going to get an abortion. And my mom was like, well, before you guys go, come out of the house. I want to talk to you. And I was like, okay, what? Because I'm not messing with this girl. Like, we're not doing that. So she was, that's when she told me she was dying. She was like, you know, I know you feel like you're not ready. But, you know, the one thing I would never ask you for anything, I was asking you to allow me to lay eyes on my grandchild before I die. Let me see a grandchild. My mother died in September. My daughter was born in February. So it was like in a 5-month span. Like, my mother died in September. Gangster was published in December. And I had my oldest daughter, Najee, in February.
Wow.
So it was like a succession of things, you know?
Mm-hmm.
So it was definitely not an easy, it was not an easy time for me. But I think that all of those things happened to me at the way, because I needed to grow up. To be perfectly honest with you, I needed to grow up. I was wild, I was bugging, I didn't respect nothing, I was throwing stones at the penitentiary. I needed to grow up. I needed to grow up before somebody killed me or I was locked up the rest of my life. So that's how my blessing came. Adversity was my blessing because it made me say, you know what? You got to put your big boy drawers on and get out in the world.
So you basically, you sat at your mom's bedside, and what were you thinking that made you start writing? You just decided, I don't have anything to do. I'm gonna start writing.
I wasn't thinking anything. It was just a reflex. It was something that just took over me. Like, I needed something. Like, it was like this. I can go out and I can wild out and I can do all kind of crazy stuff and I can tear up, but it's not going to change the fact that my mother's going to die. And like I said, my mom, like me and my mom didn't have the best relationship. When you're a kid and you have a parent, both my parents are on drugs. So when you're a kid and you have a parent on drugs, you don't understand that their addiction makes them different, that they're not in their right frame of mind. So as a kid, you're just looking at it like, you don't love me. You love crap more than you love me. So I was resentful of that.
Mm-hmm.
And when we started getting cool, like I was a little bit older, and we started getting cool and developing a relationship, boom, okay, well, you know, we're finally getting that mother and son relationship back, but I'm going to die. I'm being taken from you. So there's so many things that I wanted to say, so many things that I wanted to do. I wanted to make my mother, because I was a bum. I was living crazy. And I was like, damn, I'm never going to have a chance to make my mother proud. And she was always telling me, like, I am proud of you. You know, you may not be rich or whatever, you know, I mean, got certain things going on in my life, but you're my son, you're not dead, you're not in jail, so I'm incredibly proud of you. And it was just crazy.
Well, you mentioned that you started writing out a character based on the girl you were seeing who was arguing with you a lot. So do a lot of your characters, are they crafted based on people you know?
Most of them, the vast majority of the characters are crafted based on, like, I would say 85% of the characters are based on people that I know in real life or things that have really happened. Like certain scenarios that you may see in a book and you'll think, this is too crazy to really have happened. No, it really did happen. So this is what, you know, so it's like art imitates life. And sometimes the truth is better than fiction.
So since you're taking factual stuff and you're mixing it with fiction, how do you go about structuring the scenes?
You know what? And this is the God's honest truth. I don't know. I don't have a formula. It's like from the very first time that I ever tried to write, I just sat down. And it's like cutting on a faucet and never being able to turn it off. When I write my books, they're all freestyle. I never know what's going to happen from one page to the next. And that still holds true to this day. Like, people like, well, I do outlines and queer. I can't. I don't know how. I just sit down and I just go.
So then,
the stuff just comes out.
So then after the fact, so if I were to put this in the what's considered the writing parlance, you know, of NaNoWriMo or something like that, they would say that you are a pantser. You write by the seat of your pants, right? You just sit down and start writing. And that's a blessing to have that gift. But then afterwards, do you then go and move things around and shift scenes around? And how do you work on that to make sure that it's a fully fleshed out novel with, you know, deep characters? How do you do that afterwards, after the fact?
Well, for me, it's like composing a song. It's like a beat. You hear the beat, and if the beat, when the beat finally sounds right, that's when you know. When you have just the right string section, the right blend of horns, and it all kind of comes. It's the story tells you. You know. So it's not something that I'm conscious of. The story tells me. Like the majority of the time, when I finish myself, I hate it. I think it's the worst piece of trash that I ever wrote. Never put that on paper, but people love it. So and it's like the story tells me. That's like some of my books. Like they had to put. Like there was one point they had to put a cutoff in my contracts because I would just write. And I didn't understand, okay, you can't turn in a 300,000-word book because nobody wants to print that. You know,
right.
It costs a lot of money to print that.
Right. So what do you feel like you've learned from this writing? You know, when did you start writing again? 2002, you said, was when you published your first book. So when did you actually start writing it?
Right around then. Right about the time when my mom – go back upstairs. Right about the time when my mom got sick.
That's so around 2002.
I wrote a book. Like my first book that I wrote. Oh my God, this dog is on my nerves. The first book that I wrote was probably about 1996. I was going away to school. And that's another funny story. I just kind of packed up like a week after I graduated high school. I just kind of packed up, jumped in the car with my aunt that lived in Illinois, and she's like, "Where are you going?" I said, "With you." I'm over New York, and that's kind of how I lived my life. I was a nomad. So I wrote the first book in 1996, and I went to a gas station and bought a bunch of spiral notebooks and just started writing. And it was a vampire novel. And the most amazing thing about that is Gangster was a fluke. Gangster was a total fluke. It was a twist of the universe. It was something that wasn't supposed to happen. I wrote it because I was trying to just find a way to express my grief. But I'm naturally a sci-fi writer. But what happened was, Gangster had done so well, they wouldn't let me write sci-fi. So I did Gangster, and other deals started coming. I'm like, this stuff is cool, but this is not what I write. I write X, Y, and Z, A, B, and C. They're like, bullshit. Come. Dog. Dog. I'm sorry. I'm making sure my daughter's dog doesn't run the streets. And so they're like, this is bullshit. Like, you don't write that. This is what you write. And I was trapped in that box for so long, and no matter how hard I tried to get out. So what I eventually ended up having to do was, if you go back and you look at my early stories, there's always a supernatural character in the stories.
Yeah.
So it's like, and so I was like, okay, I'm going to make you. Because what it was, and this is the way it was explained to me, you were a street dude from the project. What could you possibly know about writing a sci-fi novel? Furthermore, how can we ever get people to take you seriously as a sci-fi writer? That's just basically how it was broken down to me. So I'm like,
wow.
It doesn't matter where I come from. My demographic should not play a part in my skill. And they're like, nah. So it took a lot of years. It wasn't until years later when my name had gotten big that I was able to start doing sci-fi. And even with that, I had to do it under a pen name because they wouldn't. They wouldn't let me write it under my real name because they said people are not going to take you seriously. You are the weed smoker, the Hennessy drinker, the project bench sitter. Who is going to take you seriously as a sci-fi writer? Look at you, and I'm sitting there looking at myself in these Chuck Taylors in his Dickie suit like, you may have a point.
So do you mind if I ask what's your pen name that you write the sci-fi under?
I never tell. It's a game I like to play. If you know my style, because the names from my street novels reappear in the sci-fi novels, and you'd be surprised.
Oh.
People are always like, "That's so unfair." And my pen name is actually my middle name and my father's last name. So if you go to my early books, when I used to acknowledge everybody, if you look on like the copyright pages, they used to put my whole name, Kawan K. Ford, my middle name. So
okay.
I use my middle name. And my father's last name, and I just changed the gender. So now I is a white woman. And you'd be surprised how many people have come back to me like, I know who you are. And they'll hit it right on the head.
Wow. And let me ask, and I'm asking you a few questions, but we have, just so you know, the phone lines are lit up and we have people want to ask you questions. But I have so many questions about that, because when you write under your pen name, do you feel like you're writing your authentic? Do you feel like your authentic self?
No, to be perfectly honest with you, and it was see, the pen name was a gift and a curse, because it always felt like I was hiding. you know, in a sense. And also, I would always hear echoes in the back of my mind, like, people are not going to take me seriously as this. So there were certain things that if I could do it over again, that I would have did differently as far as writing those stories, because I didn't have the control that I would like to have had, because I just went along with everything, you know, just kind of like, okay, yeah, I'm just so happy to get it out. And the reviews for the first couple of books weren't that good. It was like they treated me like a first-time author, and they really kicked me in the bum, you know. And it was kind of like, okay, well, now that you see that, like, we sold books, like I sold a lot of books under the pen name, because that's when books were popular like that. And they're like, okay, well, now that you've got out of your system and these reviews have kicked your butt, are you gonna quit? No. It's like for me, it's rediscovering the love of writing, being a first-time writer all over again, learning where my strengths and my weaknesses are. Because you're never too big for criticism. I don't care if I sold a million books, 2 million books. You're never too big for criticism as long as it makes sense. So I think that me jumping out the window like that, it made me appreciate the genre more. Because those genres are so very different. Like, for example, in a street lit novel, I can take, and I'm really good at this, taking 10 different characters in a story and giving them different personalities, different lives, different struggles, and weaving it all together and making it work. You can't do that in sci-fi. You can't. You have to have 2 main characters and maybe a couple of sub-characters. You can't go beyond that. And I had a lot of characters in the books. And so that was the thing. And people were like, it's very cliche. There are too many characters. The story is hard to follow. So I said, okay, lesson learned. So as I wrote more of them, I got better at it.
So what would be your best advice for aspiring fiction writers?
Write what you want to write. Damn, be damned what an editor says, be damned what an agent says, be damned what a publisher says. You write what's in your heart. You write what's in your heart. You know how much better I felt as a person and as a writer once I discovered that I could tell people no, that I could control my own destiny, that I didn't have to go along with what everybody else suggested. This is not to say that I was given bad advice, because some of the stuff works. Like, I worked with one of the best editors in the world, Moni Patterson, the same one as Rest. And I credit her a lot for helping me sharpen the sword. But for me, as a person just dealing with different publishers and just different literary entities, once I discovered the power of saying no is when I discovered the value of myself. When I could tell somebody, like, I don't want to do this. I ain't got to do it. You can't make me do it. Or you can't change this in my story. No, you can't change it. Correct it for grammar. You can't touch the content. And I stand on that. And you can't make me budge from it. So I would tell them, like, and I always tell people that people be like, yo, what's the best advice you can give a writer? Write from your heart. Write every book like it's going to be your last, because it just might be. The industry is very, very fickle. And you'll be, what's up, man? And you'll be hot today, and they'll be on to somebody else tomorrow. There was somebody else in the big chair when I came in. You know what I'm saying? It's like there'll be somebody else in the big chair after I'm gone. So I don't plan on going away no time soon. So it's like I'm sorry. Go ahead.
I'm sorry.
What I was saying is, if you look at the difference in, like, as far as generational writers, like maybe writers that have been out maybe like the last 5 to 10 years, it's a trend. It's kind of like rap music. It's a trend because there's so many people writing what's popular as opposed to what they feel. I had an author one time submit a book to me, right, and I read it and I said, I know you can write better than this, like. I'm not really feeling this book. I said, I want you to take this. I want you to throw it out. No, not literally. I want you to take this, and I want you to write from your heart and give me what you would write from your heart if it was not genre specific. And the other project you turned in was dope. And I said, man, why would you not give me? Because I thought this was what you wanted, because that's what everybody's reading. No.
And was this an urban author? Was this someone trying to be an urban author?
No,
what were they writing?
They submitted an urban story, but their strength was in mystery.
Ah, okay.
And they were just like, well, I didn't think you would want a mystery. That's all I read is a mystery. Like Walter Mosley and guys like that. Like, that's what I read. I read a lot of urban fiction, too, because you kind of have to know what's going on. But my purpose is mystery. Mystery, suspense, that kind of thing.
So let me ask you then, based on that, where do you see urban literature going in the next several years?
You know, it's hard to say. It's up and down. Me, I try to remain neutral in my opinion of the state of urban fiction. Because it's like this. When we started out, there was like five of us. It was like me, Vicky, Shannon, Sister Soldier, and Terry Woods, right? But now there's a bunch of writers. But in the beginning, I didn't have anybody to tell me. Like, when I was doing things that I had no business doing as a writer, I didn't have anybody to pull me to the side to say, hey, man, this is how you do this if you want to get ahead. So it's the same thing. So, like, they only write what they know, what they see. This is like people say, oh, these 99-cent books or whatever, whatever. That's their thing. Let them do it. If that's what they need to do to make them great, let them do it. Don't stand in the way of progress. The only thing that I ask is that you always put your best foot forward on the story. Don't undercut the story. I see a lot of people, everybody's a writer now. And everybody's not a writer. You have to be born. This is not something you can be taught in a classroom. You cannot just, you know, everybody's a writer. And people are accepting mediocrity. Like, we came up in an era when people would walk up to you at a book sign and tell you your book sucks. You need to go back to the drawing board. Now it's like everything is five star. Everything is great. Everything is great. And it's really not. And I feel that you're doing an author a disservice if you don't tell them what they're lacking. Like, you have to have thick skin to be a writer. If you don't like a book, tell them. Because if you don't tell them, then how will they know what the next book? So if one book is trash and you accept it and you give them a pat on the head like, man, did a good job, they're going to give you another trash book. And then it becomes a whole cycle of trash books just circulating around. And there's a few in between that are dope writers. Like, there are a lot of really talented writers that fly under the radar because it's so hard to weed through bullshit. See my language.
Well, what about the argument? What about, and I ask this because I personally think that the technology has made it so that we can democratize storytelling. People can tell their stories, and that's important. But there's actually an argument against urban fiction at all, that it's too violent, it's too sexual, our community doesn't need that. What are your thoughts on that?
Why don't we need it? This is where we live. This is a lot of the babies are getting young. The babies is having babies, and the killers is getting younger. This is what we live. This is the reality for some of us. You can't sweep it under the rug just because you don't like to look at it. If it ain't your cup of tea, don't read it. But don't say that they don't have a right to write it or to express that aspect of their life and what they see when they look out the window. Because you're not living that. You're not living that, so you can't judge them. You can't say that. You can't say that. I have a saying, like, if you're offended reading it, imagine how we feel living it. Think about it. Think about what some of these kids are going through. You got gangs, you got bullying, kids committing suicide. Society is jacked, man. It's jacked. And we need to keep shining a light on it. We need to keep shining because maybe we shine enough lights on it, somebody will do something about it. You think we like to live in impoverished conditions? You think we like to have rats, roaches, no heat? You think we like that? You think that's pleasant for us? A lot of these stories come from pain. A lot of these stories come from grief. Like, when my first story, I didn't have anybody to talk to. I had to put it on paper. I had to put my grief on paper. It's either put my grief on paper or maybe one day you should be dragging you out the car, knocking you upside your head. Pick your poison. So you have to have an outlet. And for all the people who are offended by it, there's a great deal of people that we help. Because if you see me and I walk on a book sign, I dress regular. Like, I look just like the everyday dude, you know. So so you have somebody else that comes from an uncomfortable, and they look at me and they see me, they be like, well, damn, he looks just like me. If he was able to pull himself up, if he was able to better himself, then it's possible for me to do it too. It's not, it becomes a possibility, it becomes tangible. This is one of, like, when my first book signing, right, they wanted me to wear a suit. And I said, I'm not wearing a suit. And they said, why don't you want to wear a suit? I said, because I wouldn't wear a suit no other time. So why am I going to go in there and I'm going to perpetrate a fraud? You have to accept me as who I am or not. And it ended up translating to people being inspired. Like, still to this day, like, I get people to hit me up, like, yo, man, I used to sneak and read your books in grade school. Like, yo, you helped me do so many tough times because I felt like you understood what I was going through. Nobody else did. So why should I not? You know what I'm saying? So why, like, you know, it's like reality. You don't say, when people write about stuff that goes on in suburban America, just because we're not living it, we don't call it offensive. We don't down it. We don't thumb our noses at it because we don't understand it. I used to read a lot of Eric Jerome Dickey books. And I couldn't never really, like, and I enjoyed the writing, but I could never grasp the lifestyle because I wasn't living that. Like, these people had good jobs. These people were drinking good wine. These people were listening to jazz. I'm on a project bench with a 40. I was listening to hip-hop. So I couldn't, but I enjoyed the stories nonetheless. And what it did was it broadened my mind, and it made me want to explore other things. Like, how many times you may be reading a book and you come across a word you've never seen before, and you look it up. It's a good word.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, wow, that's a solid word. I like that word. You know, so it's all about feeding your brain. And something else people don't look at, like, okay, they may start out reading urban fiction, but eventually they will want to gravitate to something else. They may want to read a Maya Angelou after reading the Quran. They may want to, you know, go on to something else. But it's the point, like, you have to get them started. Because some people never picked up a book until urban fiction and then went on to become voracious readers. Have to get them started by any means necessary. So what if they have to start on the Quran or Nicky Turner or this or that? You know, if they're moving on to something else, if they're feeding their brains, that's the important thing, they're feeding their brains. Then you have the aspect of it where sometimes you may be curious about a certain lifestyle. And you read the book, like I had somebody, a joker, send me an email, like, I wanted to join a gang until I read Gangster and see what happened to Lulok. I don't think gangs are for me. So they were able to learn that gangs are not for them by reading a novel as opposed to going out and doing something stupid. So this is the stuff that doesn't get talked about. And I agree with some of the points when they say urban fiction is too much of that, because the craft is not being respected and people are not making writers respect the craft because mediocrity is accepted. If you have $20 to buy a stock photo, boom, you're a writer. Upload it to Kenzie. So there's no growing, there's no grooming, there's no going back and forth, there's no like editorial process, there's no growing pains. So if you don't, you know, so how do you know to respect it? Like, if you didn't have to, if it was easy for you, sometimes you have writers that come out of left field and they go on and become overnight, say, I got 10,000 downloads. All right, cool. But what did you learn?
Right.
How are you growing? If you're still writing, if your writing is still at the same level 3 years from when you started, and you're not learning anything, and you're doing the genre and yourself a disservice.
So who would you say inspired you as far as work that you read? What are your writing influences?
I used to love Anne Rice. I was a big fan of Anne Rice. Walter Mosley, Donald Barnes and Iceberg Slim, of course. I'm big on Jackie Collins now. I just discovered Jackie Collins not too long. I love Jackie Collins because Jackie Collins wrote urban novels, but they don't call them urban novels. If you read those Angelo stories, those stories are gangsters.
Yeah.
But you don't call them gangsters because they're white folks.
Right.
You know what I mean? So, people like that, people who make me want to go back to the lab and brush off my stories and do a better job. These are the people who inspired me. And, of course, my mother was my biggest inspiration because this is her dream. I didn't want to be a writer. My mother wanted to be a writer. I didn't care about writing. I was a painter. What do I care about writing? You know, so it was like, so for me to be able to live her dream is why I take it so seriously, because it's like living your dream is one thing. Living somebody else's dream is a whole different animal. So I have to take it seriously. My mother died before she could get published. And right when she died is when I got published. So it was like that was her parting gift to me, this talent that I have, this skill. I didn't know I was writing. So you have to take it seriously. Because I'm like, damn, you know what? My mother was a better writer than most of these people out here. But she never got a chance to show it because she died. So she fell into that percentile, like that, you know, what is it, like 1 in every 1,000 people or something like that. So she was one of the 999 that didn't make it.
Right.
So you have to take it seriously. Like, I take my craft very seriously. Like, I'm a beast when it comes to from my regiment to just my storytelling. Like, I can spend a whole day writing a paragraph, the same paragraph, over and over until it rings right. And it may be just the removal of one word.
Right.
But it has to ring right. And I'm harder on myself than any publisher or any reviewer or any editor, anybody else could ever be. And that's what sets me apart.
So, you know, I have to ask, because when I asked about your writing influences, the first name you said was Anne Rice. And, you know, I'm from New Orleans, and Anne Rice. I'm just saying. If you saw my bookshelf right now, you'd be like, wow, she reads some Anne Rice. And I'll always buy them in hardcover because it's Anne Rice. But
you got to have it in hardcover.
You know, I'm like, whoa. So I noticed one of the books of yours that I'm reading is set in New Orleans. And
Diamonds
and Pearls. And, you know, that delighted me. tremendously, just because anytime I see my city featured, hopefully it's featured well, but, you know, that was delightful. But I noticed you're using what they call magical realism, or at least that's what I saw a hint of, magical realism. You were talking about supernatural characters.
Yes.
So how much of that do you put into your novels, and why is that feature important to you?
Because it's what I love. I'm a big fan of the supernatural. Everything supernatural, from movies to television shows to books to paraphernalia, like all these graphic t-shirts and stuff, I am a huge fan of supernatural. And the fact that I was told that I could not write it. This is like, it was like, in no uncertain terms, no, little black boy, we're not going to accept this from you. No, you can't write this. Now that I can't, but I give it to you in doses when it works. Like with Diamond Story.
Right.
Diamonds, I started writing Diamond Story right around Hurricane Katrina.
Okay.
And believe it or not, when I wrote Diamonds and Pearl, I had never been to New Orleans at the time. I had when I wrote the second book, I had been to New Orleans. But, I had never been to New Orleans at the time. So it was just like, but that element, that dark, morbid element, like that, just that dark, spooky. And it's so cool the way you work it into street fiction, because it gives the characters a different kind of appeal, I guess is what I'm trying to say. If you go back to all my books, there's always a character that has some type of dark element. You had The Cross and Gangster. You had Cain and the Hound and Street Dreams. You had Priest and Hoodlum. And then, of course, you had Animal in the Hood Rat books, and just so on and so forth. So that's always my thing. So there's always going to be like a little splash of that. There's always going to be a little splash of that in the books, because that's where I get my shits and giggles. That's what gives me a kick. That's what makes my characters different, because it gives them a different layer. Yeah, Diamonds is a villain, but he's not an average villain. He's running around with his black dagger doing all kind of soul snatching. So it's different.
Right.
It's not super over the top to where it doesn't fit in the story or it's awkward. It's gradual. It's a gradual thing, you know. It's a gradual, kind of like a subtle, not gradual, subtle. It's a subtle thing.
Well, I have to tell you, it's been some inspiration for me, because one of the challenges that I have had as a writer is that I lean toward what, again, that magical realism kind of element, and I always felt like it was so hard to figure out how do you integrate that element into, you know, modern fiction without being a hack,
You know who was a master of it, and one of my biggest heroes, Leslie, L.A. Banks.
Oh, okay.
L.A. Banks, and she is so near and dear to my heart, and I'm going to tell you why. When I first started writing, I had really, really bad experiences. Like, anything bad that can happen to a writer happens to me in the beginning, right? From bad deals to money being stolen to whatever, just a bunch of just really messed up stuff. So I'm trying to remember how I plugged in with her. I was a fan of her stuff, and so and it's what happens. Her daughter was a fan of my stuff. So you know, like with any like I'm a fan first with a lot of writers. So I would hit her up, like, you know, hey, love your stuff, you know, and she was responsive. So I was kind of pouring my heart out one day, and I'm like, you know, she was like, you know, my daughter likes your stuff. And I'm like, that's cool, but I don't think I'm going to write anymore. And she was like, well, why? Why aren't you going to write anymore? So I was just explaining to her what was going on with me. Like, yo, these people over here robbing me. I'm broke. I'm still living in the hood. I'm selling all these books. They're not paying me. Like, it's not worth it. It's just stealing too much of my soul. And so she said to me, boy, you better not let them people make you give up on your dream. You know how blessed you are to be published. And she just gave me a real stern talking to. And she didn't know me like that. And she was like, I'm going to tell you what I'm going to do. I'm going to tell my editor. She said, you got an agent? I said, no. She said, get an agent. Don't matter. Just get an agent. And I'm going to tell my editor about you. And I want you to submit your next book to St. Martin's Press. I'm going to give them the heads up that it's coming. And I said, you would do that? She said, yeah. She said, because, you know, you have a guest, and I don't want to see you squander it. And it ended up, well, and then I got an agent, and my agent ended up robbing me. That's another story altogether. So, you know, and so the first book didn't get there, but just the fact that she went through that, and whenever we would see each other at events, I would take my hat off and I would tip my forehead to the back of her hand. And you know, like, and I'm Kawan now at this point. So people are like, who is this woman who you have so much respect for, and why? Like, what is it? Because they didn't know, because they didn't know who she was and what she was about. And I'm like, man, she helped me at a time when I was ready to, you know, cash in and go back to doing what I was doing. So when she died, it hit me really, really hard, because she was always so nice. She was always just such, like, I mean, you ever been around her, you ever met her, one of the best people you could ever know. And
wow.
She stopped me from giving up. And people don't know that, so I credit a lot of my success. And it's so odd, because when I finally did get signed to St. Martin's Press for my third book, they asked me one day at a meeting, like, yeah, whatever happened to Road Dogs? Leslie said you were going to give us Road Dogs. And then I had to go on and explain to them how I had the agent, and the agent gaffled me, and I went through some more growing pains before I came back full circle.
Wow. Okay, so I'm going to pause right here because we have a caller,
okay.
Area code 404. Maybe we can see if our caller has a question. Caller, are you there?
Yes, I'm here.
So
hello.
Do you have a question for Kawan?
Yes. Have you thought about making any of your books into a movie?
Absolutely. Absolutely. We're working on some stuff now. Like, as you would know, like, we started filming from Harlem with Love, but we had to stop production because we had a situation with one of the guys. So I'm definitely actively still pursuing getting my stuff onto the screen, because that's just the natural next step. And everybody's waiting for that animal movie, but I'm saving that for the right situation. We have had a bunch of offers, some good, some bad, but none of them have been necessarily right to this point.
Well, I wanted to say that I respect you, and I'm very proud
you.
Of you, because a lot of people start writing books, they start doing well, getting some success, and then they start getting deterred and start doing other things.
Mm-hmm.
And then
yeah.
when everything else is falling apart, now they want to go back to writing. So, you know,
I know.
That's
I could think of five people. I probably know just who you're talking about, but no, I'm just playing. But I'm not.
No, you probably do. You know what, though? You probably do.
Yeah, I see it happen all the time. People achieve success, and they forget their roots. And you have to stay grounded, because the moment you start believing in your own hype is the moment that your blessing is taken from you, and the magic is gone.
Oh, yeah, definitely. I have a client of mine that her husband just passed away, and he was a book editor. And she said
that.
He did, yeah, yes, and she would be happy to hear that. She never went into the basement until after he passed, and she said, I think every book he's ever edited is in that basement, and now
wow.
she has to shred everything. So, you know, by her not taking the time when he would say, come and look, and this, that, and the other, she said, at least if I took the time to look, maybe I could do something with it, but I can't do anything because I never took the time.
That's sad. And that
mm-hmm.
is really sad. And I know how that can be, because in the beginning, nobody supported my dreams. Not my friends, not the woman that I was with at the time. She used to tell me, you're a criminal. You can't be no writer. You're good at breaking the law. Who's going to ever read anything you write? So it's like, that hurts. Like, when you, especially when something you're passionate about, and nobody believes, and people that you lay next to every day don't really care about what it is that you're passionate about. It's a really, really sad thing. And I'm pretty sure she didn't do it intentionally. It just wasn't something she was into. So, you know, and then, you know, for him to pass like that, and then for her to see all these great works, all this stuff. And I don't ever want that to be my story.
Yeah, but that is really good that, you know, but it's just very stressful when I see people with relationships, and it's like, even if you really aren't into it, take the time to read up and learn about the person that you're supposed to love, what they're
yeah.
involved in. Because when you don't, then that's a percentage of the relationship that's dying or that's
yep.
dead. And then when it's over, I was packing up and I happened to see this book and I read it and it's beautiful. It's too late now. The beauty
late,
is gone.
Yeah.
So will
you.
You
got to give them flowers
you know?
When they're alive.
Exactly.
When they're living. Don't wait until they pass. You know, that's a terrible thing. My daughter's mom, she didn't start reading my stuff until like years after we broke up. Like, wow, you really did have a time. You really did. Hey, Janice, am I talking too loud out here? Am I talking too loud? Okay. Yeah, so, you know, so it wasn't until years after that she started reading stuff.
But that's kind of like what I'm saying is that when everything is gone and they're sitting and questioning, now you want to look. But if you had been reading, you wouldn't have to question. Maybe things worked out.
This amazing talent hiding right underneath. But you know what plays a part in that, too? As writers, and I don't know if it's the same thing with editors, as writers, we're very isolated people. Like, when I'm living in my head, I'm living in my head. I don't want to be bothered. Like, you know, I can be like, if I'm in my office, I'll feel like I was only in there for a few minutes, right? When in all actuality, I may have been up there for 6 or 7 hours. And I'm thinking, well, I only been up here 20 minutes. So it's like writers, and then we have these, like, these personality quirks, because the truly great writers are the ones that step into their characters. So sometimes you have the residual residue of this character still clinging to you like a second skin. And people don't know how to deal with that. They don't know how to really take that. Like, you know, not knowing, like, it's just very different. Like, I always tell people, I can never articulate in words what it is that I do and what drives me to do it, how I do it. It's like a language that very few people speak, where you see things in colors and, you know, in shapes. And it doesn't translate into words. Like, kind of how whales, how they have, like, they have the sonar communicate the sonar. Like, what the hell are they talking about? So it's kind of like that.
Well, I'm curious. Thank you so much, caller, for your comments, for your questions.
You.
I really appreciate you reaching out and being on the line for us today.
No problem.
Thank you so much, and I appreciate your call.
You're welcome, and keep up the good work. I'll be looking
thank
for
you.
More books.
I got you. I got something coming out of the pipe in a hot minute.
Okay.
Well, you mentioned something that I think is pretty important for authors out there. You mentioned that you had some problems with the agent, and it sounds like some of the deals didn't go so well to begin with.
Oh, yeah.
What kinds of advice would you give to authors about going through that publishing process and getting an agent, things that maybe you learned that could help them avoid similar issues?
Well, first and foremost, understand your paperwork before you sign anything, because like when you're getting that first contract, the first thing you look at is how much you're gonna get paid and when you're gonna get paid, and then everything else is kind of like blur. So with my first contract, there were a lot of things I didn't understand, and I didn't want to be the dumb black kid that, you know, was just stuff that I didn't understand. So instead of me asking, I just assumed and went ahead with it. So that created a lot of problems for me too, because a lot of the stuff that was happening to me, I have walked myself into it contractually. I did it to myself. With my first one thing I learned is that with my books, and I got maybe like 40 books out, I own 100% of the film rights to all of these novels. I didn't know that in the beginning. So with my first contract, I gave away 50% of the film rights because I didn't know any better. And I had to fight to get those back. And it took me 10 years to get all that sorted out. So you definitely need to know and understand the contract. Secondly, before you sign with a publisher, look to see what kind of success or failures they've had with other authors who are signed to them. What can they do for you that you can't do for yourself? Because, you know, like we said earlier in the show, like with social media and the digital stuff, it's easier to get published now. Back in the days, you needed $10,000 to come to the station. It's not like that anymore. So,
right,
understand that paperwork, because you'll be like, oh, the publisher's robbing me. And then you'll go back and look at the fine print of the contract, and no, they're not robbing you, you signed that. So you should definitely know, and don't fall on the trends. Like, people, I've noticed, like, the new trend of, instead of writing for sales or to reach readers, people are writing for Facebook and Instagram likes. Facebook and Instagram likes ain't going to feed your kids. Facebook and Instagram likes will not create a legacy for you. God forbid, if I die tomorrow, they will remember me for all time because I gave it everything when I did it. I'm immortal. I will live forever in the pages of these books And not just as someone who wrote a book, as someone who cared about it, someone who got down, someone who really get, who really gave it to you when they did that. So you got to think about what you want your legacy to be. You want to be a fly-by-night? You want to be a flash in the pan? You want to be a one-hit wonder? Or do you want to be great? Do you want to be timeless? Do you want, like, years after you stop writing, people to still be like, yo, because, like, not to my own horn, when you talk about urban fiction, my name has to come up in the conversation. And it's not me being cocky. It's just a fact because I put so much into it and I sacrificed. Even still to this day, I'm going through growing pains. You know, trial and error, different things you learn and you grow. You can never, every day you're going to learn something new. You can't learn everything in one day. Take your time. Be a student of the game first. I couldn't be a proficient writer if I wasn't a voracious reader. If I didn't read a lot, then I would, you know, I would have a limited vocabulary and I wouldn't know how to construct stories. When I wrote my first book, I didn't know what the tab bar was for. For my indent, I would count four spaces on the space bar, and that was my indent. I didn't know.
Mm-hmm.
So be a student of the game. Read the people that came before you. Pay homage to the people that came before you. I'm not saying you had to kiss nobody's ass, but just acknowledge the sacrifices in the hard work that was put in and that allowed opportunity. I tell authors, like, I had to take a bad contract so I can know how to tell you what a bad contract looks like.
Right.
So this is the sacrifice that I made. So don't just jump out the window and do some nut stuff. Respect that. Look at all the writers who came and who got fleeced. Like, if you look at that documentary, one of the most pertinent things in that Portrait of Repentance documentary we did, it was talking to Odie Hawkins. And he was telling a story about when he went to Holiday House and was like, yo, you know, my sales, based on what y'all paying me, like, it's not matching up. Y'all beating me. And the guy told him, he said, come here, come to the window. I want to show you something. And he pointed out the window to downtown, wherever it was at, Detroit, wherever it was at, and was like, I can throw a paper wad out this window and hit 10 of you. So you either take what I'm giving you or get out the way.
Mm.
And it was so sad because that's still going on to this day. It still happens to this day. They still feel like they can feed us whatever, and we just have to accept it. And we don't. If we educate ourselves about the craft, if we study the craft, we don't. We don't have to take stuff. Because we were selling books before I got signed to a major. I had sold 80,000 books on the street before I even knew what a major publisher was. Barnes & Noble didn't kick Gangsta up until 6 months after it was published. So if we, you know, so I say all that to say this, like, we were our own majors, you know?
Right.
And there's nothing wrong with being signed to a major, but don't become so dependent on that major house to where, like, if the chips is down, you can't get out there and get it on your own. Because it's going to be a sad, sad time for you when it comes to the point where they realize that you've outlived your usefulness and you're obsolete. And you can't feed yourself because you've been so dependent on this system of just turning books in and sitting back. It don't work like that. Grind. Hustle. I still do book signings on street corners. And I'm, what, 16 years in? Because that home.
Wow. You know, I have to switch subjects a little bit because we're coming, you know, to the top of the hour.
Okay.
And this is Love, Lust, Lovers. So
uh-huh.
People are going to want to know about the sex scenes in particular. So talk to us about sex. Talk to us about sex in your novels.
You know what's crazy about that? In my first maybe two novels, my first two novels, there was no sex scenes at all. I went back. I actually went back and wrote in sex scenes in The Gangster when we reissued it. And Vicky said to me one day, she said, what is your problem with sex? And I said, what do you mean? She was like, well, you got a daughter, so I know you're having sex. Why don't you have any sex scenes in your book? And I'm like, it never dawned on me. It never occurred to me. Because it's like, when you write books, right, people naturally think that what you're writing about is you. And, you know, it is a part of who you are or what is going on with you. So I was a little funny about that. And it took me a while to kind of open up. Like, if you read, like, the story I wrote, Wild Cherry, like, it's all kind of crazy sex in there. It's even, like, same-sex relationships. So I had to kind of push myself to step outside because it's a natural thing. And I noticed, like, a sex scene, a few well-placed sex scenes, it adds depth to your book because people are having sex. You know, there has to be, like, you know, it's like you have these guys that are in these relationships with their girls, but you have to show the intimacy. You can't just show them taking them shopping and killing for them. Show the intimacy. Show why they love them. Make the readers feel. And it's so funny because in the first few books, I had to draw from real life stuff to come up with these things. So some of the stuff that's kind of out there, it was real. It was a true story.
So to get the wilder sex scenes, how do you research that if it's not what you're into?
Oh, I dig in the old memory bank. I think one of the most I think one of the most difficult things was it was like in Wild Cherry, because it touched on same sex relationships, and I've never been in a same sex relationship, so I kind of had to stretch the boundaries of my imagination. And one of the questions asked of me was like, "Are you sure you want to write about this?" And I'm like, "Why?" And they're like, I just said, you know, people automatically assume what you're writing about, things you've experienced. So if you write about the same-sex relationship, you're not afraid that people will look at you funny? I'm like, no, not really. I mean, anybody that knows me knows that back before I was married, I was a peahound. So that's really, you know what I'm saying? So it's like, you know, it is what it is. You have to be able to step outside. You have to stretch the limits of your imagination. And just because the best books are the ones where there's no holds barred, where you just bare your soul, you just lay it all out and let the chips fall where they may. Those are the books that get you the best responses and the best feedback.
Okay. We have another caller. Let's see. That's 917, area code 917. Caller, are you there?
Hello?
Hello?
Is that me?
Hello? Yep, that's you.
Hey, what's up, Quan? This is Anissa.
Hey, what's up, Anissa? What's up, girl? What's going on?
None much. Just trying to get ready to run to the liquor store. I was trying to listen to your interview. But
that's why I was, you know, that's why I was at when we started the interview.
I just said, let me call in right quick. Yeah, me over here laughing about that last thing with the sex.
What? Listen, you know, I tell these stories all the time. Listen, back in the days where I was, you know, so I had to draw from those experiences. And people were like, oh my God, Kawan, you write some real crazy sex things.
Because when she asked that question, I'm like, wait a minute. And I'm like, well, he didn't really need the sex scenes like that, but okay. His books are so good with, even without the sex scenes. So,
but it makes sense now, right? You're like, oh.
Yeah. I'm like, oh, you had to dig in the memory bank, huh?
Yeah, so. I had to go back into those, I had to go back to those early 20s memories.
Yeah. But what's going on from Harlem?
From Harlem with Love?
Yeah.
We had to stop production on it because what happened is the main character, and you know the film follows primarily Harlem, the main character. The guy who's playing Harlem had gotten into a personal situation that I'm not going to put his business out there.
Right.
And they wanted to recast him. And I said, we're not gonna recast him because that part, it was perfect for him. So I would rather just wait until he gets this sorted out and move on to something else for right now. So we're trying so like probably in about a couple of weeks, we're going to go into pre-production for another project that I have. You know, I got a bunch of stuff. And Yeah. But that was like, and everybody was so excited about From Harlem with Love. Because not only because they were waiting for Kawan to do a movie, because I was doing it on my own.
Right, exactly. And I knew that it would be, you know, like the book because you was doing it.
Yeah, and that's why I write my own scripts, because sometimes when you have people adapt their scripts, they don't get your vision. So I would write my own scripts, you know, and just do it like that. So that way I know, you know, this is all on me, good, bad, or indifferent. This is me. This is my vision. This is how I want it to read.
Okay, yeah. Okay, so I'm just patiently waiting for that part five. And
I told you, I'm full of Beyonce. I'm not putting no date on it. I'm just going to drop it and let y'all go ahead and do what y'all do.
Okay, that's fine. All right, I just wanted to call and say what's up.
Thank you, baby girl. I appreciate it.
All right.
Thank you so much for calling.
All right, you're welcome. Bye-bye.
All right, well, we are a little over an hour, and I want to go ahead and wrap up because I know your time is valuable. It is Friday night. You want to go and have fun. But what do you have going on that you want our listeners to know about?
Oh, I got some good stuff coming out. Well, of course, Animal 5 that everybody's been waiting for. All I'm going to say is that you will get it this year. I'm not putting a date on it. And the reason, let me tell you about Animal. With Animal, I love that character. I love that series. But it has become so redundant and so repetitive because I wrote about nothing but Animal for so many years that I had to say, I started to resent the character. Because that's all people wanted from me. All the readers, all the publishers, that's all they wanted were animal stories. And I'm like, I am so much more than just animal. Like, read some of these other stories. But I'm finally going to go ahead and put that out there. I have a book coming out this year. We don't have a date for it yet, called Lawless, which is a legal thriller. Yeah, then I got I have a couple of projects. And I have another project. I don't really want to throw the name out there yet, but people do steal. So I never say the name of a certain project until the project's in production. So, like, you can expect, like, 3 books from me this year, and we're going to, like I said, we're going to get back to filming. Also have some events coming up, doing Hood Book in Detroit in May. Shout out to Hood Book, Michelle and all those guys down there. I'm supposed to be in Virginia. Is it Richmond? Richmond, I believe it's Richmond. I think, yeah, oh, God, I hope it's Richmond. Richmond, to do an event down there. But, you know, other than that, I'm just kicking back, man. I'm writing these scripts. I got a really dope television pilot that I'm trying to put some legs on right now. My plate is pretty full. Thank God, knock on wood, you know.
That's awesome. And where can people find you? How can they follow you? Where can they buy your books?
You can buy my books on the street corner. You can buy them at Walmart. Anywhere books are sold, you can follow me on Twitter as Kawan the Writer. I'm on Instagram as Kawan_IAmLegend. You can visit my website, KawanFoy.com, KWANFOYE.com, and that will connect you to all my emails and social media. And when all else fails, Google me, and my Wikipedia page will pop up.
Awesome. Well, Kawan, thank you so much for joining me on Love, Lust, Lovers, Late Night Literature. It has been awesome.
Thank you for having me. Great questions. And I appreciate more than anything out of this whole interview, you pronounced my name correctly. And I appreciate that.
Oh, thank you. Thank you.
People butcher my name all the time.
I know. That's terrible. Oh, and let us know when you're going to come out to L.A. Make sure you need to let us know so we can, grab a coffee or grab lunch or something.
Absolutely. Hopefully I will get back out there at some point this year. I usually come to L.A. when it's cold. When it's cold up here, that's when I like to come down to L.A. So,
Full disclosure, right now it's a little chilly and overcast in L.A., but it only lasts for a day or two, and then it's back to sunshiny.
I know. I need to get back out there, man. I loved it so much. I always try to find excuses to come back, so hopefully soon.
Awesome. Well, guys, that is our show for this week. You can reach out to me online at urbanbookeditor.com or on Facebook and Instagram as Urban Book Editor. Send me a note. I'd love to hear from you. You can also find me on my channel somewhere in the middle. My next show is going to be Friday, March 23rd, at 5 p.m. Pacific, 6 p.m. Mountain, 7 p.m. Central, 8 p.m. Eastern, and you can find it at bit.ly/somewhereinthemiddleradio. You can also find the replays at bit.ly/somewhereinthemiddlepodcast. And also, you need to keep your eyes open for that season finale of Love, Lust, Lovers, Late Night Literature, where we're going to have on May 25th, Essence best-selling author Donna Hill. Again, so then we will hear from you on that night too, then, right? You're going to call in?
Absolutely. Yeah. Donna, good people, man. I love Donna Hill, so I definitely will call in and support her.
Awesome. Great night, guys. Again, a big shout out to Beverly Black, Tribe Family Channel, and all the members of Tribe Family Channel. It is a pleasure and an honor to be a part of it. Thank you to our sponsors, Urban Book Editor, and the creators of the Player Line book series and relationship enthusiasts, Hosea and Tinsley Brooks. And a huge thanks to Kawan for being with us this evening. You guys be good.
Thank you.
Stay mindful.
Thank you for having
Remain
me.
Prayerful. Thank you. And I'll see you guys again on Love, Lust, Lovers, Late Night Literature on Friday, April 27th, 9 p.m. 9 p.m. Eastern, 8 p.m. Central, 7 p.m. Mountain, 6 p.m. Pacific. Our guest will be author Anita Dickerson Knox. Peace and blessings, y'all.
Have a good night.
Thank you. You too.
Light a fire, and I'm gonna hold you close to me, girl, and we gonna make love.